is the thing. For example, in the case of New York Times versus Sullivan, the very famous libel case, the New York Times republished the libel and became standing in the same shoes as the libelous party. By republishing a libel, you have equal responsibility. Under Section 230, you have zero responsibility. So the user-generated content that you're indifferent to. So I think some happy medium needs to be found between this absolute immunity for harmful content and a free expression. So, for example, my students work a lot with hate speech in the graduate class. One of their assignments is to develop a hate speech policy for an imaginary online company. And we look at Facebook's hate speech policy as an example. And it's just a horrible mismatch of jumble of impossible to predict or interpret rules.
Educator and attorney Ed Leonard teaches communications law at the University of San Francisco. He says his work is at the intersection of communications theories and democratic practices. Ed joins John and Scoop on this episode of the Plutopia Podcast. We discuss the fairness doctrine, hate speech, cancel culture, and much more.
Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia News Network Podcast. Today, our guest is Michael Edward Leonard, who I know as Ed Leonard. Ed has 25 years of experience teaching law, communications, and journalism at the university level. He's taught both master's and PhD level students. He's also a licensed attorney in California with 30 years of experience. And he's taught communications law and other classes at the University of San Francisco since 2009. So welcome, Ed.
Welcome, John. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, we're very happy to have you here. And I guess the first thing we should ask you, we've talked to some other people who are academics who are involved in education about how COVID has affected their experience. How has it gone for you with COVID over the last year?
That's interesting. Your mileage may vary. I think every academic has a different relationship to their students and a different subject matter, so I could only speak for myself, but I've found it very productive and very engaging to interact with my students on Zoom the last 12 months.
Has it?
It hasn't been a problem. And that's because I think I have a degree in television.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you kind of know how to use the tools, right?
Yeah.
I think that makes a big difference. Part of the issue that I think some people are having is kind of like we were having a little bit of a bandwidth issue today. And I think that that has been a problem with some of the online classes is the sort of diversity of bandwidth. Some don't have enough bandwidth to participate as well as others. Have you had that experience?
And also some stuff. Usually I'm in San Francisco and things are good. This semester I'm teaching freedom of expression, and I have a student in Hanoi, Vietnam, and she's logging in twice a week. And sometimes she turns her camera off to keep the bandwidth low, but she participates every week from Hanoi.
Oh, that's cool. And how about just personally, have you had COVID issues disrupting your life at all?
I've been very fortunate to be spared. I know a lot of people who have not been fortunate, some of them close friends or relatives, but personally, I've been okay. So it's been all right. I'm not strongly impacted as some people might.
Yeah, that's great. That's terrific. So when you're teaching communications law, a lot of people would have a kind of black box view of that. They don't really know what it is exactly. What are you actually teaching? What are you focusing on in communications law?
Well, my key perspective on it is to see that law is really a forum for resolving social and political conflicts. Many people, when they teach communications law, it's a brutal introduction to a very complicated set of contradictory rules. Libel law alone is miserably complicated and difficult even for specialists to understand. So I ask my students not to see themselves as experts in the law, but rather to see how libel law becomes a forum where a conflict over something in society that's important is resolved. We start by looking at Martin Luther King in the South during the civil rights era, and his organization is attempting to run a full-page ad in the New York Times. And the New York Times runs the ad, and it has some derogatory statements about Southern law enforcement. And Southern law enforcement sues Martin Luther King and the New York Times for libel. They don't sue Martin Luther King, but they sue his team. So then all of a sudden, I think the question of actual malice and the rule becomes interesting, because you see it in a social context and you see why this rule needs to be in place as opposed to the prior rule. So that's sort of my take, as we go through indecency and obscenity and national security and reporter's privilege, but always in the context of a social issue. And so I've developed an approach I call media law in 10 movies. So each week we watch a movie and read a companion Supreme Court case that goes with the movie. So most obviously, People versus Larry Flint is a movie, and it's also a court case. And it works out pretty well. The undergraduates grasp that pretty well, that they see that this is not just something abstract and distant in their life, but this is something going on right now.
Well, the Supreme Court just had an interesting decision just recently regarding the Oracle versus Google, or Google versus Oracle, whichever way you look at it, suit over the Android operating system code that they borrowed. And on the surface, it might not seem like a communications issue, but the fair use doctrine seems to be at the heart of that, and that's very important when it comes to media and communications. What do you think about that decision?
Well, excellent point. First, to say that one of the things that we focus on in my class is the fair use doctrine. If you focus too much on copyright law, you immediately get into a deep forest of difficult and narrow rules. But fair use is one of those things where the joke is someone asks you, is it fair use? And the lawyer looks at his notepad and says, it depends, you know, very sincerely. So this case with the Android, I'm not familiar with the details, but the purpose of copyright law is to encourage innovation by rewarding innovators for a limited period of time. And unfortunately, what we've seen is a regime that, rather than encouraging innovation, copyright law becomes a club to club competitors with. And I think the Supreme Court is becoming increasingly aware that the underlying purpose of copyright law is not to grant hugely profitable monopolies in perpetuity. And I think hopefully this case is a good step in that direction, where we recognize that we share code like we share language. And my favorite story about that was a trademark story when IBM came out with its personal system 2. John, maybe you remember back in the 80s or 90s, there was PS2. And they tried to trademark 2. And the court said, no, you may not trademark 2. You all have to use that number.
That would have been interesting. So
you cannot take a trademark, something we all need.
In thinking about this, it seems to me, I mean, I've always heard that there's not much precedent regarding fair use, so it's hard to know exactly how any court case will be decided because of the lack of precedent. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is correct. A fair use is largely a case-by-case analysis, drawing on four factors identified by the Supreme Court in the Harper and Roe case, which was a case concerning the pardon by Gerald Ford of Richard Nixon and the Ford memoirs, and whether or not the nation could take just a very few words out of that manuscript. And a lot of it, fair use, is whether or not you're stealing an exclusive right or you're doing economic damage. But again, fair use is not precedential. It's a case-by-case analysis. So if it was true in this case, it's only a guideline for a future case. There is no binding precedent in that way.
Another really hot communications issue that we're hearing a lot about right now involves Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and the, you know, the kind of safe harbor provision. What do you think is going to happen with that? Have you got a sense of where we're going? There's some talk about legislation to overturn or modify Section 230.
That, of course, would be the subject for a whole hour of conversation just by itself.
We got an hour.
Section 230, of course, is a very unusual rule that arose almost by accident. It was not really an intentional rule to exempt someone from liability for what they say so broadly. In my classes that I teach at the graduate level, we look at the case of Hassell versus Berg, or Berg versus Hassell, where an attorney is on Yelp and a client who's dissatisfied is viciously criticizing that attorney on Yelp. And as it turns out, this is California Supreme Court has ruled that even if the attorney and the client have a judgment, Yahoo or Yelp or whoever else is doing the platform doesn't have to respect that order. So if the attorney says, this review has been found to be libelous and false, I insist that you take it down, Yelp Corporation, Section 230 prevents the attorney from having any recourse against Yelp should they leave up the false and defamatory review.
But isn't that just a matter of properly assigning accountability to the person who actually contributed the content or speech versus holding someone accountable that may not even know that the speech existed on their system?
In one sense, yes. I mean, the client was hit with a huge judgment for the falsehoods that were damaging that the client said about the attorney, but the damage persisted as long as Yelp did not take that review down. So the attorney tried to force Yelp to take it down, and Yelp refused to take it down on the grounds that Section 230 did not require them to, even though they knew and admitted it was false and defamatory.
Yeah, that's an aspect of it that never really occurred to me. And it almost seems like, I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't take it down, especially since it was found libelous.
Well, the thing is, they don't have to. They could if they wished, but then they're starting to engage in editing, which is something that they would like to avoid under Section 230, because the closer you are to being a publisher rather than a platform, the further you are away from your Section 230 protections.
Well, and it seems to me that if we actually, let's say we just abolish Section 230 and remove that protection, it seems like what we're referring to as platforms now, like Facebook and Twitter and so forth, would have to become more like publications. They would have to vet and control what's published on their platform, which to me, it seems like it would completely... it would be like the end of user-generated content, wouldn't it?
Well, this is the thing. For example, in the case of New York Times versus Sullivan, the very famous libel case, the New York Times republished the libel and became standing in the same shoes as the libelous party. By republishing a libel, you have equal responsibility. Under Section 230, you have zero responsibility. So the user-generated content that you're indifferent to. So I think some happy medium needs to be found between this absolute immunity for harmful content and a free expression. So, for example, my students work a lot with hate speech in the graduate class. One of their assignments is to develop a hate speech policy for an imaginary online company. And we look at Facebook's hate speech policy as an example. And it's just a horrible mismatch of jumble of impossible to predict or interpret rules. So I think some new order has to come to the Section 230 domain, where something like Facebook is a publisher. They cannot avoid that. They're not just a platform anymore. They have all kinds of algorithmic responsibilities which they carry out for their advertisers. They need to carry out some responsibility in preventing hateful speech.
You know, hate speech has been big in the legal news lately. Our local media titan, Alex Jones, had his suit tossed out or rejected by the Supreme Court. They didn't want to deal with it. So he's going to have to pay legal fees for all the parents from the massacre that he said was all actors. So that was an interesting development. I didn't expect him to at least look at it, but apparently it just didn't make the cut, as has some of Donald Trump's attempts to get the Supreme Court on his side. And the Fox News host, Tucker Carlson, claiming the defense of, you know, no one in their right mind would listen to what would believe what I say is the truth. So there has to be some sort of accountability, but how does it? How do you balance that accountability with a person's freedom of speech?
That's the question that the judges are going to wrestle with as we move forward in the American system with the case law, where there'll be a case or controversy, it will arise, and there'll be a ruling, and the ruling of general applicability will become a precedent. We're in a difficult situation from an economics theory standpoint, and that is that if you're making a newspaper, the marginal cost of lying is one copy of the newspaper. So there's a production cost of one for each lie. The internet spreads hate and lies costlessly. The marginal cost of a the second Twitter post is zero. So it just keeps replicating itself indefinitely at zero cost. And I think this changes the sensibility behind libel and slander. For example, historically, slander was considered less damaging than libel because oral words went into the room and then disappeared and were never repeated again, whereas written words had a certain permanence to them. And that's why libel was considered a more severe or more punishable offense than slander. On the internet, we've reduced this all, and we all now call it defamation. We don't distinguish between libel and slander. But I think we need to distinguish between things which have the ability to reproduce themselves endlessly at no cost to the originator, and other forms of media which have a marginal cost associated with them.
Yeah, the whole thing of the internet is that you could say I'm sorry and I didn't really mean it and it wasn't true, but it's going to be out there forever because you can't just go out and say, well, everybody send me your copy of that post and I'm going to take it back. You can't do that on the internet.
Yeah, we're going to take it all to the landfill pulpit and throw it in the dirt. No, you can't do that anymore. You know, if somebody's book was libelous or violated a trademark, you took the whole warehouse full of bulk books, pulped them, and that was the end of it. With the internet, it's kind of a permanent record, and it's difficult to distinguish between truth and falsity on the internet, even for experienced users of the internet.
Well, one other issue is, let's say that I'm a platform and somebody is pasting persistently libelous content, so I remove them from the platform so that will put an end to the libelous content. Now I've canceled them, and there's a whole other conversation really coming from some of the same people who complain about 230, which is that you shouldn't be able to remove somebody from a platform because that is, I don't know, a part of cancel culture, that you're canceling them. I kind of don't see how those two things work together very well.
Well, you know, we have two different remedies. One would be to edit, and the other would be to prohibit or cancel. A publisher barring someone from the platform entirely is not not exercising editorial judgment in the sense that would expose them to liability under some sort of Section 230 removal.
I was just going to say, if the edit removed some part of the content, that too might be called cancellation. It's not that you removed them, but that you removed some of their content, and that you shouldn't be able to do that either.
Well, I think it takes us to a philosophical issue. When I was a student learning this, the orthodox view was that the remedy for hateful speech or untrue speech or unthoughtful speech was more speech. And so more speech was always better. I think that a couple things mitigate against the old wisdom. Number one, we live in what many people have called an attention economy. There simply just is a deficit of attention. More speech does not necessarily correct anything. It just gets lost in the myriad of many, many things. So I think that maybe cancellation or editing is necessary because we have to revisit this idea that more speech is the remedy for hurtful or wrongful speech. So that we would want to have a Facebook feel free to take down or edit comments that in its judgment were improper or hurtful. We would not want to empower them to ignore it.
Yeah, I wonder how these things get resolved. Are we going to need new legislation? You mentioned the courts. Will the courts really be able to address these issues without legislative guidance?
In my experience, all important American social and political issues end up in the judiciary. So that's where they're headed. And that's because legislation by nature creates ambiguity. And that ambiguity by clever actors is exploited, and then it becomes a lawsuit. So, for example, we have a case that will arise to interpret a law that might to everyone seem straightforward, but in practice, it's not so straightforward. So, yeah, we'll end up in the courts, and the judges will be given that power as the third branch of government to construe the law and render the actual implementation or the practice that goes with the law.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a really big question. I'm going to ask you a really big question now, because I know you're a student of James W. Carey, and I know that he wrote about the impact of the telegraph. Yeah, and in that you studied that particular work of his. How did the telegraph change communications? What was the impact on business and culture?
Well, the most important thing to understand about James Carey's work is that he sees communication in two distinct ways that exist simultaneously. One is a transmission model, and the other is what you could call a community, a cultural or ritual model. And Carey refers to the second model by various names. I'm in San Francisco, and we have Telegraph Hill with Coit Tower. And why was there a Telegraph Hill? Well, because when the ships were coming in, they had the news. And if you could get someone to send the news to you by semaphore or some other visual telegraphy, you could get the price of corn or the price of gold or the price of whatever was important in the market that day sooner than anyone else. And that advantage was extremely valuable. So if you think to the stock market, sometimes you see below it says these quotes delayed by 15 minutes. Well, that 15 minutes is the edge that the seat holders at the stock exchange got to act on the information before the general public. So the transmission model of the telegraph greatly equalized places in space. See, it used to be you trade stocks, you had to stand at the New York Stock Exchange. With the telegraph, you could give the order from anywhere in the United States to buy or sell. So the transmission model tends to bring us all into one place for the purposes of communication and eliminates the sense of distance, which used to be the long distance call. My gosh, it's a long distance call. What is it? It must be something important, right? But we don't even think of calls as long distance anymore. So the first sense is that of transmission. So it's the culture and the economy have totally been transformed by the approaching zero cost, zero marginal cost of transmission. But the other side of James Carey's model, the community, the cultural and the ritual model, the best way to think about that is to think about the Star Spangled Banner being sung before a sporting event. In a transmission model, you'd say, well, that's useless. There's no new information being transmitted. We all know the words to the song. In a cultural model, you would say by standing and singing and participating, we affirm something new and different for that moment, our unity as a people, as a culture, as a nation. And that's what I think we need to focus on as we move into the third generation of the 21st century, the third decade of the 21st century. We need to think about how is the internet functioning in this second model, not about efficient, costless transportation, but human fellowship, community, and a nation.
Well, and that would be democracy, too. I mean, how are communications and media crucial to democracy?
Well, in the original model, the post office was thought to be an essential part of democracy. And that's why there were certain postal rates and there were postal roads and there was universal service in the postal system. To send something across the street or across the nation was the same price because it was thought that the postal service binds us all together. And the same went for terrestrial radio. I used to listen to KGSR, and they would say Bastrop, Austin. That was their, you know. Well, why do they say Bastrop? Where the hell is Bastrop? Well, the license is assigned to Bastrop. And under the old way of thinking, under the community cultural ritual model, the radio station serves Bastrop. It becomes the voice of Bastrop in Texas, the community. And we used to have these rules that would say, if you own a license and a station together, you have to carry out ascertainment and ascertain what are the important needs of your community and then carry out those needs in your programming. So our practice of democracy and our forms of communication have long been intertwined. The internet has, strangely enough, separated rather than brought us together in terms of our practice of democracy.
My first job out of high school was working in radio news in the local station. And its whole purpose of that news operation was to tell the local community what's going on, what's important to them. And that was a policy of the FCC saying you were required to work in the public interest. You were a guardian of the public welfare, the public interest with your license they granted you. And somewhere along the line about the Reagan years, that went away. They were basically told, you really don't have to have local news or news at all. And you can have as many stations as you want. That cropped up actually in the Clinton years, I believe. So there's been an erosion of that whole function of local radio. It really doesn't exist anymore. They're all networked in to stream a lot of right-wing talk shows. That's basically what you hear if you go through the AM radio band in Texas. You hear very little local generated content. Is there any fix for that, or is it just a dying business?
Well, there's a lot of important law that concerns that. The trade-off, if we go theoretically here, is between liberalization of communications and democratic communications. In a liberal communication model, We were trying to reach as many people at the lowest cost. And communication policy in the 30s for radio in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s reflected that by the clear channel stations, which I'm sure you're familiar with, right? Prime time being the important time, and also being nighttime when the AM signal traveled the furthest, we had clear channel stations which could reach large parts of the nation. And, of course, those clear channel stations became acquired by the networks, and that's how we got the red and the blue, and then later, you know, CBS. That's in direct conflict with the local mission of radio. So it became a hybrid model. So during the day, it was kind of a local station, but at night they gave the program over to the network, and it was national audience with very little local content. I remember TV was that way, too. On a Saturday morning, there was Captain Kangaroo or Captain Delta, and it was a locally originated children's show for the local audience. Captain Delta was a spinoff of Captain Kangaroo for people in Sacramento, which is a Delta town where I grew up. So the requirement of serving the public interest went away at a very specific moment. And that moment was an FCC proceeding when the FCC was asked to decide whether or not home shopping was in the public interest. And they responded affirmatively. And at that point, everything was off. If home shopping serves the public interest, what doesn't? So therefore, any content you put out met your public interest requirement because, as Frank Stanton, head of CBS, once memorably said, the public interest is what the public is interested in.
Well, I didn't really realize that. I mean, I didn't know about that decision. I always thought that the thing that really screwed things up was the loss of the fairness doctrine. And I'm sure that was also very consequential.
Well, the Fairness Doctrine was a very specific obligation of a licensee to serve the public interest by, for issues of public importance, they must broadcast both sides. And if no one is available to take the other side, they at their own expense must present it. That was the Fairness Doctrine. And it's a very sensible idea that if we look at a community, cultural, and ritual model, we want that audience assembled together to be inculcated or birthed or brought forward in a democracy, which means that one side speaks and then another side speaks. It's not Tucker Carlson's show where it is only one side, even if there's other people on, that we're actually trying to have a deliberation. And I think that was the point of your book, Democracy 2.0, right, John?
Yeah, actually, Extreme Democracy, correct. That was one of the points of it.
Oh, stream doctrine. Yeah. So the Fairness Doctrine was responsible for incredible things. For example, the banning of cigarette advertising on television is a direct result of the FCC's enforcement of the Fairness Doctrine. The law professor from George Washington University, Banzaff, I think his name was, argued that cigarette smoking was a controversial issue of public importance and that cigarette advertisements were taking a public position on this public issue of public importance. And therefore, radio stations, licensee holders acting in the public interest, must broadcast anti-smoking messages in a certain number for every smoking message that they broadcast. The result of that was a congressional act that banned radio and television advertising for cigarettes, which the cigarette companies happily agreed to because the last thing they wanted was powerful and effective counter-advertising. Now, it's probably unconstitutional to ban radio and television advertising, and it has weird side effects. So, for example, you can't put a cigarette billboard inside a baseball stadium. Why? Because if the camera for a fly ball pans and catches that billboard, which is a smoking billboard, that would be a violation of the law which prohibits putting smoking messages on television because the billboard is the message on television and it would violate the law. So the Fairness Doctrine had tremendously far-reaching effects when it was being enforced.
And it went away because there was a free speech argument? Was that a Supreme Court decision?
The FCC, in a series of incremental steps, legislated the Fairness Doctrine out of existence in its own practice. The Supreme Court affirmed the Fairness Doctrine in a case called Red Lion, where it was held that the public interest was paramount, and the right of the public to hear both sides of an argument was more important to the culture and to the system of democracy than the right to make money by advertising or running programming. The Supreme Court affirmed this and said, yes, this is true. And this is in direct contrast to the law of newspapers, which in a case called Miami Herald versus Tornillo, affirmed just the opposite. It said, if you were a newspaper, no government agency may tell you to run both sides. And that was a case where Mr. Tornillo was running for office, and the Miami Herald ran him down in an advertisement saying he was unfit for office. And he said, under the Florida law, I demand a right of reply to your editorial. And the Florida Star said, Miami Herald said, forget it. And he went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, you don't have a right. No one may compel a newspaper to publish anything they do not see fit. That is 180 degrees opposite of the radio rule, which was, if you're a radio licensee, you must present both sides, or we'll perhaps not renew your license.
So what's the difference?
Between which and which?
Well, between a newspaper and a radio transmission. I mean, why what's the rationale for the difference?
A radio station is a licensee holding a license, which requires, as a precondition of the license being granted, that you serve the public interest. A newspaper, a publisher, their acts or omissions are only limited by the support of their readers and their advertisers, and they are free to do as they wish.
Wow, so the internet does away with that whole licensee thing. You don't really need airwaves anymore, right?
It basically destroys the foundation of the peg of regulation, which was the public interest principle of the licensee's license. So the internet completely takes that away. And it was actually taken away by satellite broadcasting first. All radio stations are subject to the radio law. But broadcasting from a satellite was deemed not to be radio. It was deemed to be point-to-point and therefore exempt from the public interest requirements. Well, anyway, so the radio coming from the satellite is completely exempt from all FCC regulation concerning content. Not that there's any important regulation now anyway, but that's why Howard Stern had to go on the satellite, because he was running up huge indecency fines that the FCC was slapping the terrestrial network with.
That's when we got into trouble with cable news. That's why they're able to do what they're able to do today, like Fox and basically any of the cable news stations. They don't have to cover anything other than what their advertisers are interested in.
Well, again, it's a complicated situation. Most Fox stations are broadcasting affiliates. That is, they still rely on a terrestrial signal, but then they carry the network-affiliated Fox News. So they still are subject to terrestrial requirements, you know, if it's a Fox News station in your community. The Fox News network itself is not subject to any rules, but then again, neither was NBC. NBC operated and affiliated stations were subject to the government regulation, but NBC as a network was never subject to content regulation, historically.
So what's the state of journalism now with all of this? You hear that journalism is, some people say, on its last legs because the business model is really hard to figure out. But it seems to me that it's a lot more than just the business model. It seems like there's a very sort of confusing environment now, and actually not necessarily much incentive to report the facts.
Yeah, I spent some time at a journalism school with an editor, former editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the late Cole Campbell. And I'm very influenced in some of my thinking by what Cole Campbell did when he was teaching at the University of Nevada Journalism School, and where I was a faculty member. To that problem, we can add the historical context that there used to be in the American system a notion that public service was required. You know, and it was almost a religious thing. We would say, for the prize of our high calling, I press forward to the mark. And journalism was thought to be exempt from the normal commercial rules. And then in the 70s and 80s, journalism was supposed to lose money. It was a loss leader. It was a cost of doing business. Your journalism division lost money. And this is most famously caricatured or parodied or explained in the movie Network with Howard Beale, the news broadcaster, where the news network and network is in the dumpster and they can't get their ratings out. And their lead anchor says, I'm going to kill myself on the air. And all of a sudden, there's a ratings phenomenon where everyone is watching and tuned in to see if Howard Beale is going to kill himself. And then the news people go, well, that would be a great news show. Let's give him a commentary, you know, like there's Everide and the famous commentators of the day, their names are escaping me. But other networks have the Eric Severide, yeah, have their commentary. We'll just give Howard Beale his commentary show. And Howard Beale becomes a version of Tucker Carlson, you know, an immensely predictive act. But that has nothing to do with the public interest or serving the public. It's a kind of infotainment. So the bottom line on this is that the economic foundation of public service has been cut away from journalism. And that means now journalism has to maintain its profitability based on its ability to attract the audience. And the worst development for that was the internet, because now we know exactly how many people clicked on the Iraq story and how many people clicked on the puppy story. And the managing editor is going to say, do the puppy story. That's like 40 times the readership of the Iraq story. And that's starting a spiral where journalism becomes undercut by its economic requirements. Now, famously, there was a story in the news at the Chicago Tribune or the Los Angeles Times, I can't remember, where one of the journalists stood up and said to the new publisher who had just bought it, saying, so what you want us to do are more puppy stories. And the guy says, no, I want us to be so successful that we can do stories about puppies in Iraq.
In your pre-interview document, you said us, you wrote something that really grabbed me. You wrote, I suspect that humanity is now no more horrible than it was before, but we can now see the toxins better, previously hidden from view. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. I'm trained as a sociologist, and it used to be we had to go through great structural difficulties to get data. If we wanted to find out what people were actually thinking, we had to get a subject clearance from the university, and then we had to go in the field, and we had to record what people were saying, and we had to code it using content analysis. It was all quite burdensome to find out what someone was thinking. Now we have literally a transcript of the things that people are saying. And it's a durable, permanent, searchable transcript. So I'm pretty much convinced that having my undergraduate degree is in Greek and Roman rhetoric. And the things that Aristotle says about how to create fear in an audience that he said over 2,000 years ago are still true. People are still people. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. He says, you must make the danger not so far away as to be distant, because people don't feel distant things, nor so close as to be inevitable, because people don't fear the inevitable. To create fear in an audience, you must place the thought in the audience's mind at that middle distance, neither so far away to be distant, nor so close to be inevitable. Well, this rule is still good today, and I'm confident that people's character has not changed. So I think we are about the same as we were during the times of Socrates and Cicero. But now we can see and have called to our attention the worst parts of humanity. And my Twitter feed, I realized, was a machine to make me angry. And there's a wonderful cartoon where this guy is typing furiously and his wife is calling him to bed. And he says, honey, I can't go to bed right now. I saw something wrong on the internet. So the bottom line is that now the things that used to be only said in private meetings or in pubs or in coffee houses or in the Ku Klux Klan secret quarters or in the Mediterranean Cafe at Telegraph Avenue, Berkeley. All those private places are now visible to us as observers, and we can, you know, make judgments about them.
So that's communication, kind of arguably. It's a kind of communication, and it's problematic politically, as we have seen, and it makes it much more complicated for us to have meaningful conversations that of the kind that would effectively drive democracy. So I'm wondering about, I mean, I think I just articulated a problem. I don't know how to solve it. It's like a wicked problem. It's like the genie's out of the bottle. Pandora's box is open. The bees are heading straight for us. Do you have any thoughts about solutions to this problem?
I can tell you a story that bears on it. I have a friend, a woman who's a professor from Bulgaria, and we've talked a lot about different things. And if you look at our culture, it would be easy to see that we are consumed with our own self-interest and our own excess. We are, in a Protestant way, sinners. You know, we are outside the boundaries of what much of our moral tradition would teach us about our own individual behavior. We are all focused on our own identity and our own pleasure and our own self-interest. And sadly, the remedy for that is a catastrophe and suffering. That is how history has shown us that when a society becomes obsessed with the wrong things and gives its attention in the wrong way, that some systemic event occurs, and through suffering, we have a change of heart and there's redemption. And I was discussing this with Nadia Kanava, who's a professor at the University of Denver. And I said, so like Russian literature, that we are facing a period where suffering will bring our redemption. And she looked at me and said, oh, that's the optimistic version of Russian literature. It may be our time that there is just going to be suffering without redemption, that we have created a world that was feared when I was a graduate student. Famously, Susan Haddon, who you know, John, said to me in 1992 when I was a graduate student, she said, what if everyone could have their own web page? And she imagined that as kind of an information utopia. Well, now everyone having their own web page, we can see that it is further from any utopia than any of us could have thought in the 1990s, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Our name, Plutopia, is a portmanteau of pluralist and utopias. And it came from, we did an installation at a maker fair, a big installation on the DIY home of the future. And the idea was that the home of the future would be highly configurable and that in effect, you could sort of make your home exactly what you want it to be, a sort of mini utopia, you know, that you would have exactly the environment that you want. So that's where we come from, pluralist. Everybody can kind of have their own utopia, basically, their utopian dream realized. And we thought that was a cool idea. But, you know, now I look back on it and I say we weren't looking at the dark side of that thinking, really, which is that not everybody really wants to have sweetness and light. Basically, and we have created a world where, in effect, it's not so much that everybody has their own web page, but certainly everybody can have their own Facebook page or their own Facebook presence and Twitter presence and so forth. And there's so much in the air that is various levels of problematic, you know, ignorant, violent, crazy. And I'm just kind of back to the same thing. I don't know how to put the genie back in the bottle. And I just wonder if we're sort of doomed or I mean, I know that you're thinking a lot about the impact of communications on democracy and kind of what's happening now. And democracy itself has always been challenged, right? I mean, it's fragile. It's hard to have a democracy, and a pure democracy could mean everybody has a say in everything, which, you know, you probably don't want. I mean, populism. So again, I mean, I'm just kind of wondering if somebody asked you, what would you advise? What should we do to start to address this problem of maybe too many voices in the air or too much confusion in the air? As a person who's focused on communications, do you have something that you or some steps that you would recommend?
I have two, one which is practical and one which is outlandish. The practical is that we need to recognize that throughout history, human institutions are of paramount importance. And we saw that during the January 6th insurrection riots at the Capitol, that our institutions are what make us different or separate from other nations in our shared belief and faith in these institutions. And my favorite quote from that day is someone said, January 6th, it was the worst day in American history, unless, of course, you've read a book about American history. So we need to focus not on our grand institutions like the Supreme Court and the Congress, which we do, and we need to reform money in politics, and we need to overturn the idea that dollar equals speech and that money is speech. We need to think about public funding of elections. We need to think about how we count votes, you know, the ridiculous procedure that there's somebody in Wyoming who has two senators, and proportionately that person has way more influence in the Senate than I do in California, where I have two senators. You know, we're looking at just a ridiculous structural problem with our institutions. But that's for another day. But what I would want to talk about now is we need to think about our local institutions and our personally connected institutions. And the reason why is that my discovery, which was taught to me, it wasn't really a discovery, but my affirmation of the discovery is that we are only good in virtue of each other. That I, by myself, with no one watching, I'm going to do things that I'm not proud of, that I would not want to be known for or share. It is only in the context of a community, in the context of a long continuing in time institution, that my behavior improves. And so I think we need to rediscover these local institutions where, you know, the person you did wrong in a real estate deal, you sit next to in the pew in temple or church, right? That these institutions require us to achieve what, you know, Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. So that would be number one. We have totally neglected our local institutions. One of the institutions I miss the most is Vulcan Video. Do you remember Vulcan Video, of course, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
There was a place in Austin, Texas, where they cared about movies so much that they were not alphabetized by title, but by director, right? And that people cared about movies and about content and about what was being said and what was the message. And that's a community of a moral dimension as well as an economic dimension, I would make the case. So that's my practical solution, is that we disintermediated a lot, you know, Blockbuster disintermediated Vulcan Video, and whatever community was left in Blockbuster was destroyed by Netflix. Now, whatever we have as a community is sustained online through automated recommendation agents. Oh, if you liked this, you might like this. It's not going down Blockbuster and hanging out with a person behind the counter, the clerk who has an encyclopedic knowledge of movies, which he's been disintermediated because I have IMDb, right? I don't need him anymore. So I would say long-term focus on local institutions that carry forth our culture and our values. Are you ready for the outlandish one?
Yes, yes.
Okay, here's the outlandish proposal. Donald Schutzen and some people at San Diego came up with the idea of the monitorial citizen. That is, that we're all not smart enough to be citizens in all dimensions of our activities. And we count on certain people. Perhaps, John, you and your community are the voice for telecommunications policy. Someone else is the voice for agricultural policy. And we rely on these citizens to inform us about these difficult and complicated issues, genetically modified crops or Section 230. So I got to thinking, you know, maybe we need to embrace the same things that are harming us, and that would be artificial intelligence and agency. So I don't have any problem using an artificially intelligent agency to buy something for me on eBay, right? I can program a computer to make the best deal for me on eBay in my bidding, in my searching, right? Well, what if we were to apply that same kind of logic to politics? So that rather than me personally participating in politics, I would have a persona, a avatar, a digital embodiment. And that digital embodiment would know what I want. And a legislature would then be the collectivity of all the digital people sending their representatives to this great forum where we then work out the public interest. So, for example, it's well known that if you ask people, do you want better education? Do you want lower taxes? They answer yes to both questions. And it's well known in political science literature that these are incompatible answers. But my agent could adjust my views in relationship to the community's views, and perhaps we could reach a consensus. So what I would call for is a huge, you know, moonshot kind of project where we would start to figure out how we could have democratic interaction, not personally, because we don't have time for that. I barely have time to defragment my hard disk. But we could train our agent to go into the political marketplace and represent us. And the way that would work would be is that agents of collectivities like the Sierra Club would train my agent in behaviors that the Sierra Club would want to see me acting like as a citizen. Now, this is completely outlandish, but I hope I maybe explained it in the time we had available in a way that was at least intriguing.
Algorithmic democracy.
Can't wait for the Russians to try and hack that one.
Let me just say, it was a long time ago, somebody said to me when I was even in, you know, long time, said, Amazon knows you better than your spouse. You know, if you have to guess what book I was going to read next, my spouse wouldn't know, but Amazon might, right? We need to harness that technology to make shared collective life possible.
I actually sleep with Amazon. I have a Kindle in my bed.
In a bit of irony, the last blockbuster on the planet is now a cultural icon. They have fans all over the planet just because they're the last blockbuster and they're hanging in there with videos.
Videotapes?
Yeah, I've got a funny story about that real quick. I was at a marijuana law conference, and this guy was a speaker. And the blockbuster in Las Vegas is closed. But now it's a marijuana shop, you know, where they're legally selling marijuana. And he was saying, when I was younger, I'd go in the Blockbuster to make trades, you know, deals, illicit trades for marijuana. So he goes, I've been selling marijuana in that Blockbuster almost all my life.
It really is a Blockbuster.
Yeah, it repurposed. The Blockbuster store is now a cannabis retailer.
I'm not sure what to make of that.
We take our bag and go home and smoke it at home and watch Netflix.
I wish that we had time to talk more about that conference and the laws around cannabis, but we do appear to be pretty much out of time.
You'll have to come back.
Absolutely. Let's do a follow-up.
It's been an enormous amount of fun, and it's been great to connect with you again, John. And it's so nice to see you. This has been fun. And obviously, this is what beer was invented for.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.